All right, get ready because today we're going deep, really deep, into California manslaughter law.
Ooh, sounds intense.
It is. You guys sent in some really interesting legal documents about a case called People v. Beltran.
Ah, Beltran, a classic.
Yeah, we're going to try to figure out, like, when does that whole heat of passion defense actually work? You know, how provoked does someone have to be to get their murder charge, like, knocked down to manslaughter?
It's a tricky one for sure. That line between cold-blooded murder and a crime committed in the heat of the moment,
Yeah.
it can get really blurry.
To set the scene a little, People v. Beltran involves a relationship, a restraining order, and then a really tragic death.
Right.
Jose Beltran and Claire Timponco, they were, I guess you could say, estranged, right?
Yeah, the court records show they had a super volatile relationship, lots of domestic violence. She even tried to get a restraining order against him.
Didn't stop things from going really, really wrong, though,
No, sadly not.
leading to that confrontation where Timponco was killed.
And in her apartment in front of her kids, it just adds this whole other level of tragedy to the case.
Absolutely.
It really shows you how destructive domestic violence can be.
Yeah.
The details are pretty rough.
Yeah.
But long story short, Beltran stabbed her multiple times. She died, and then he took off, fled to Mexico, and was on the run for like 6 years?
6 years.
6 years.
Wow, to live with that.
I know.
So they finally catch him, bring him to trial, and his defense is, hey, I acted in the heat of passion.
Right, claiming that she told him she'd had an abortion.
And that just sent him over the edge.
Yeah, supposedly into this uncontrollable rage.
But I mean, how do you measure that, legally speaking?
That's where it gets interesting.
Right.
Was that revelation, considering their whole history, enough to make an ordinary person snap like that?
Okay, wait.
Yeah.
Ordinary person.
Yeah.
So it's not just about how Beltran felt, but how, like, the average Joe would have reacted.
Exactly. California uses this thing called the Logan Standard. It sets an objective, like, benchmark. Okay.
It asks, would this provocation make an ordinary person act without thinking, without
Yeah.
deliberation, rashly, you know?
So if I'm on the jury, how do I judge that? What's an ordinary reaction? Everyone's different.
Right. That's the hard part. The ordinary person standard is this, like, hypothetical thing. It's meant to be a measuring
The
stick.
measuring stick. Okay.
Trying to get rid of all the subjective stuff, like the defendant's personality or whatever you're focusing on. What was the provocation so strong that it would just overwhelm anyone's judgment?
So it's like this legal avatar,
Yeah.
imaginary, reasonable person we're asking, how would they react in that moment?
Exactly. So the jury had to decide, given everything, would hearing about an abortion push this ordinary person to act rashly?
And rashly doesn't necessarily mean killing, right?
Right, that's key. The Logan standard, it doesn't say the provocation has to make you kill. Just act rashly, lose control. It's about that loss of control, not the specific outcome. So even if this ordinary person wouldn't have killed, the question is, would they have just snapped, you know,
Yeah.
gone off the handle because of what was said?
Yes, precisely. And the California Supreme Court made this super clear in People v. Beltran. They said, straight up, the provocation doesn't have to make a reasonable person kill. It's about whether it makes them act rashly.
Got it. So that's one of the big takeaways from People v. Beltran. But in Beltran's case, did the court believe him? Did they buy his heat of passion argument?
Well, the jury at first, they convicted him of second-degree murder.
Which means.
They thought there was at least some premeditation.
But then.
But the Court of Appeal, they actually reversed that conviction.
Wait, they overturned the jury.
Yeah.
Wow, why?
They weren't sure the jury had been properly instructed on heat of passion. They thought maybe the jury believed the provocation had to make an ordinary person want to kill, not just act rashly.
Oh, so it all goes back to that distinction we were talking about.
Exactly. The Court of Appeals thought those jury instructions, they weren't clear enough.
So muddy waters.
Muddy waters. So it went up to the California Supreme Court and they reinstated that murder conviction.
Wow.
But here's the thing, their reasoning is what makes this case so important for figuring out heat of passion going forward.
I am on the edge of my seat.
Yeah.
Tell me, why did the Supreme Court uphold the conviction? What they say about Beltran and his whole heat of passion claim?
Well, they focused on a few things. First, they said this wasn't some sudden out-of-the-blue provocation.
Okay.
Beltran and Tampanco, they had this long history of conflict, and he had been violent towards her before.
So it was like, hold on, this wasn't just a one-time outburst, there's a pattern here.
Yeah, exactly. Was this really an impulsive reaction, or was it part of this, you know, ongoing pattern of abuse?
Right.
And then they brought up this really important idea, it's called cooling off time.
Cooling off time. Yeah. I feel like this is about to get really interesting.
Yeah.
It is, because the heat of passion defense, it hinges on this idea that someone acted on impulse right in the heat of the moment. But if they had time to calm down, to think it over, then the defense falls apart.
So it's like, if someone insults me and I punch them right then, that's different than if I, like, stew about it for a week and then go after them.
Right. If time passes, it's not that pure uncontrollable reaction anymore.
Makes sense.
And with Beltran, the court said he had lots of time to cool off between that alleged abortion comment and actually killing her.
So the fact that there was all this history, plus the cooling off period, that's why the Supreme Court tossed out his heat of passion defense.
Right.
This case, People v. Beltran, it feels like it really set the standard in California law.
It did, big time.
So what's changed because of it? What should lawyers and judges be taking away from this?
Well, for one, People v. Beltran firmly established that Logan standard. Right. It's like they gave everyone this measuring stick and said, use this. This is how we figure out if the provocation was enough for a heat of passion response.
So if I'm a defense attorney trying to use this defense, I know what I need to do. I've got to convince the jury that what happened was so bad, so provoking, it would make any ordinary person act without thinking, regardless of whether they'd kill or not.
Exactly. And for prosecutors, they've got a way to fight back. They can argue that, hey, what happened wasn't bad enough to meet the Logan standard, or that the defendant had tons of time to cool off before doing anything.
So, People v. Beltran, it brought some clarity to this whole heat of passion thing, but it still seems, I don't know, tricky. How can you measure something like human emotion? How do you really know what would push an ordinary person over the edge?
That is the million-dollar question.
Right.
And honestly, legal scholars, they debate this all the time. That ordinary person standard, it's trying to bridge this gap between someone's personal experience and, you know, these objective legal rules.
It's like you're trying to bottle up what's normal and then use it to judge someone's actions during a crisis.
Yeah, but what's normal? What bugs one person might send someone else through the roof?
Exactly. So how do courts figure this out? How do they make sure the ordinary person standard is being used fairly consistently?
One way is through jury instructions. Judges will often tell the jury to think of this ordinary person as someone with average intelligence, average temperament, self-control.
So you create this, like, baseline, a generic human, and you compare what the defendant did to that.
Right. Is it perfect? No. But it's an attempt to be objective about something that is really subjective.
It's a philosophical puzzle for sure. What does it even mean to be ordinary when everyone feels and shows their emotions so differently?
And this is where culture can get really tricky, too.
Oh, okay. Cultural considerations. Tell me more.
Well, when you think about it, that whole ordinary person standard, it assumes everyone's on the same page.
Right.
Like, we all agree on what's normal or reasonable, but we don't.
No.
What's a friendly gesture in one culture could be a huge insult in another.
And what might be a little annoying to me could make someone else totally lose it.
Exactly. So how do courts balance these universal legal standards with the fact that, you know, people experience things differently?
Yeah. How do they handle that? Do they adjust the ordinary person concept to take culture into account?
Honestly, there's no easy answer. Courts have tried different things. Some experts say the standard should be flexible, that it should change based on the cultural context of the case. Others say, nope, it's got to be applied the same way no matter who you are or where you come from.
It's like, are you trying to create this one-size-fits-all definition for emotion?
Yeah, it's tough. This is definitely an area where the law is still evolving, trying to find that sweet spot where you recognize differences but also keep things fair.
This is so interesting, this heat of passion thing. Every time we talk about it, it's like another layer gets peeled back.
It's complex.
Okay, so we've gone deep into the law, the philosophy, all of it. But what about the real world? If someone is facing this defense as the defendant, or maybe they're related to the victim, what advice would you give them?
Easy. Get a lawyer, like yesterday.
Don't mess around with this.
Don't mess around. This defense is packed with legal nuances. You need an expert.
Someone who really understands how this heat of passion thing works.
100%. A good attorney can help you figure out if the defense is even worth trying. They can gather evidence. They can build a strong case, whether you're arguing for or against heat of passion.
So, step one, find the right lawyer. What else?
Don't assume heat of passion is a free pass.
Like, oh, they made me mad, case closed.
No, not at all. You still have to prove your case.
Right.
You have to show that the provocation was legally valid.
And that your actions were a direct result of that provocation.
Exactly.
Not some, you know, hidden motive you had.
It's a high bar to clear.
Yeah. And for the victim's family, I imagine it's just as important to have someone on their side. Legally speaking.
Absolutely. They need someone to make sure their rights are protected, that their voice is heard.
Because even though we're talking about the defendant's state of mind, the victim's story is important too.
It is. Their loss, their experience, it all needs to be acknowledged, regardless of what happens in court.
That's really important. This whole deep dive into People v. Beltran, it's not just about legal theory. It's about real people, real emotions, real consequences.
You got it. It reminds us that the law, it's not just words on paper, it's about human lives.
Okay, I feel like we just, I don't know, untangled a huge knot of legal stuff.
Yeah, we did.
But you said there's even more to talk about.
Oh yeah, lots more. We've been focusing on California, but these questions about provocation, emotions, criminal responsibility, they're everywhere.
So what we've talked about, it goes way beyond just California.
Absolutely. The stuff we've discussed, it applies all over the world.
Wow.
It's fascinating, you know, this area where law meets psychology, sociology, philosophy.
And I think that's a good place to stop for now.
It is.
This deep dive into heat of passion, it's been a wild ride. Legal precedents, tough concepts, lots of questions.
For sure. It's been great unpacking this with you. And to everyone listening, thanks for sending in this case. It sparked a really interesting conversation.
We love hearing from you, so keep sending in your legal questions. And until next time, remember, the law, it's constantly changing. It's alive. So stay curious, stay informed, and keep those legal minds sharp.
Couldn't have said it better myself. You know what's interesting about this whole heat of passion thing?
What's that?
How it ties into the different types of murder.
Oh, you mean like we've been talking about it, reducing murder to manslaughter?
Right.
But there are different levels of murder itself.
Yeah, exactly. You've got first degree murder, which is like premeditated, planned out.
Right.
And then there's second degree, which is usually more impulsive, you know, without that planning.
So where does heat of passion fit in? Could it, I don't know, could it bump a first degree charge down to second degree?
Oh, absolutely. If a prosecutor is going for first degree, but the defense successfully argues heat of passion, you could end up with a second degree conviction instead.
So even if it's not enough to get it all the way to manslaughter,
it
could still make a huge difference.
It shows you how powerful this defense can be, why it's so important to understand the details.
Yeah. Okay, so we've been talking theory, but I'm always curious about, like, real-world examples.
Right.
Are there other cases, besides People v. Beltran, that show us how this defense actually gets used?
Oh, tons. California case law is full of them.
Okay.
Like, People v. Berry.
Okay, what happened there?
A man killed his wife after she basically taunted him about cheating on him.
Oh, wow. Sounds like something you'd see on the news.
Right.
Classic heat of passion situation.
You'd think so.
But
the defense argued it wasn't just the cheating itself. It was this, like, long history of psychological abuse.
Okay.
Leading up to that moment, they said it was that pattern of behavior plus the final trigger that pushed him over the edge.
So it's less about one big explosion, more like a pressure cooker. Building and building until finally.
I like that, the pressure cooker. And the court actually agreed. They said, yeah, the wife's actions, all of them together, they could count as enough provocation under that Logan standard.
Interesting. So it doesn't always have to be one big thing. It can be this series of smaller things, right?
Exactly. It can be this slow burn. People v. Berry, it adds this whole other layer to how we understand provocation. You got to look at the whole situation.
Right. The whole relationship, the lead up to the crime. It's not just about that one moment.
Right. So you've got People v. Beltran, which gives us that objective standard, and People v. Berry, which shows us that provocation can be this long process.
Right, right. Any other, like, landmark cases that have really shaped how we think about this in California?
Oh, for sure. There's People v. Borchers. This one, a man killed his girlfriend after she said she was leaving him for someone else.
Another, I guess, love gone wrong situation.
Yeah. What makes Borchers interesting is that it brings in expert testimony.
Okay, we need.
The defense called a psychiatrist to testify about the defendant's mental state.
So they were trying to, like, back up their argument with science.
Right, exactly. They wanted to show that, hey, this guy's reaction, it might seem extreme, but for someone with his condition, it was actually a pretty normal response.
So they're saying, put yourself in his shoes, really understand where he's coming from.
Exactly. Did it work?
Did the court allow it?
They did, which is a big deal. But they also said, you know, be careful with this kind of testimony.
Right.
Because in the end, it still comes down to that ordinary person. Would someone without any mental disorders have reacted the same way?
So the expert can provide context, but they can't change the rules.
Right. The court was super clear about that. It's not a free pass to just excuse violence because someone has a mental disorder.
You know, it seems like every time we talk about these cases, this ordinary person idea comes up.
Mm-hmm.
But who is this ordinary person? Like, is it just this made-up legal thing?
It's a good question, and a lot of people debate it.
Yeah.
The ordinary person standard, it's meant to be like neutral to help us judge these really emotional situations.
It's like trying to, I don't know, capture normal in a bottle and use it to judge someone during a crisis.
Yeah. But normal, it means different things to different people.
Exactly. So how do courts deal with that? How do they make sure everyone's using the same definition?
Well, they use jury instructions. Judges will often tell jurors to think about this ordinary person as someone with, like, average intelligence, average temperament, average self-control.
So basically a generic human being.
Kind of. And then they measure the defendant against that. Like we said, not perfect, but it's an attempt to be objective.
It's a weird puzzle. Trying to figure out what ordinary even means when everyone expresses themselves so differently.
And then you add culture into the mix. It gets even more complicated.
Okay, hold on. Cultural considerations. How does that play into the ordinary person standard?
Well, think about it. The ordinary person idea, it kind of assumes we all see things the same way.
Right.
Like, what's normal or reasonable? It's the same for everyone, but of course it's not.
Not at all.
Like, a gesture that's friendly in one culture might be super offensive in another.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
What's a small insult to one person could be a huge deal to someone else.
Exactly. So do courts ever adjust the ordinary person idea based on culture?
It's a tough one. There's no easy answer. Some people think the standard should be flexible, that it should adapt to the situation.
Okay.
Others say it's got to stay the same for everyone, no matter what.
It's like trying to create a universal language for feelings, which is, I mean, impossible.
Right. It's a work in progress. The law is still trying to figure out that balance, recognizing differences, but also keeping things fair.
Man, this whole heat of passion thing, it's like an onion. We keep peeling back layers.
Yeah, it's complex. Goes really deep.
So we've talked about the law, the philosophy, all that. But let's say I'm facing this defense in real life. What should I do?
Get a lawyer. ASAP.
Okay, so you're saying don't try to handle this myself.
Definitely not. This is not the time to be your own lawyer.
Right.
Find someone who knows this defense inside and out.
Okay, so finding the right lawyer is key. What else should someone in this situation keep in mind?
Don't think of heat of passion as a get out of jail free card.
Right.
Just because you were provoked doesn't mean you automatically win.
It's not that simple.
Nope. You still have to prove your case.
You have to convince the court that the provocation was enough and that your actions were a direct result of it. Not because of something else.
Exactly. It's a high bar to clear. And for the victim's family, it's important they have a lawyer, too.
Yeah, to make sure their side of the story gets told.
Absolutely. Their loss, their experience, it matters.
This has been, I don't know, eye-opening. This deep dive into People v. Beltran, it's not just about the law. It's about people.
Mm.
And the choices they make.
Yeah, it shows you how complicated these situations can be. How much is at stake?
Okay, so we've untangled a lot here, but I have a feeling there's still more to come.
There is. We've really just scratched the surface. We still need to talk about how People v. Beltran affects judges and juries, how it's changed the way things are done in courtrooms all over California. Plus, we've got some other really interesting cases that look at heat of passion from different angles.
Ooh, I can't wait. Let's keep this deep dive going. Okay, welcome back. My brain is like fried after all that heat of passion talk.
Yeah, it's a lot to unpack.
It really is. It's crazy how one case, People v. Beltran, can change so much about the law.
It shows you how courts are always fine-tuning things, especially when it comes to like human behavior.
Right, because people aren't always rational.
Definitely not.
You mentioned that Beltran also changed how judges handle jury instructions in these heat of passion cases. What happened there?
Well, one of the big lessons from Beltran was that jury instructions, they have to be crystal clear. Remember how the Court of Appeal, they overturned the conviction because they thought the jury might have been confused?
Yeah, about what's enough provocation.
Exactly. So the Supreme Court, when they gave their ruling, they actually provided specific language for those jury instructions.
So like a template.
Yeah, a legally approved script for judges to use.
So everyone's on the same page about what heat of passion means, legally speaking.
Right. It standardized things, less room for, like, misinterpretation.
That makes sense. Consistent instructions are so important to keep things fair.
It's amazing how one case can have such a practical effect. It changes how things are actually done in courtrooms.
This whole deep dive, it's been wild. We've talked about Logan cooling off that whole ordinary person idea, even how culture can make things more complicated.
I know, right?
But I feel like we've just scratched the surface.
We have. We've been talking about California, but these questions, they come up everywhere. Provocation, emotions, responsibility.
So it's not just a California thing?
Nope, not at all. These ideas apply to legal systems all over the world. It's this fascinating mix of law, psychology, sociology, even philosophy.
Yeah. And I think that's a great place to leave it. This heat of passion deep dive, it's been a journey.
It has. Lots of twists and turns.
We've gone through precedents, tough concepts, all sorts of thought-provoking questions.
It's been a pleasure talking about this with you.
Likewise. And to everyone listening, thank you for sending in this case. It's led to a really great conversation.
And keep those legal questions coming. We love hearing from you.
Until next time, remember, the law is always changing. Stay curious, stay informed, and keep those legal minds sharp.